This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, sitting in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. You may know Senator Tom Cotton from the news. The Arkansas Republican is known for his hardline stances on things like Iran and immigration. His new book explores something altogether different, but it shines a light both on his past and his politics. Sacred Duty, a soldier's tour at Arlington National Cemetery, takes a look at the Old Guard, the Army's ceremonial unit in Washington, D.C. Senator Tom Cotton, welcome to 1A.
Thank you, Sasha. It's good to be on with you, and thanks for your interest in Sacred Duty.
Absolutely. Senator, now I promise we will discuss your book in a moment. First, can we deal with a few issues in the news?
Yes, of course.
This weekend, Congressman Justin Amash, a Republican from Michigan, weighed in on the Mueller report and its aftermath. He tweeted, "Contrary to Barr's portrayal, Mueller's report reveals that President Trump engaged in specific actions and a pattern of behavior that meet the threshold for impeachment." Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I do not, Sasha. As Mr. Mueller concluded in his own report, the president did not, and his campaign did not collude with Russia. I know there's a lot of other material in the report as well about potential acts of obstruction. I just think it's somewhat far-fetched to say the president obstructed an investigation to something that did not happen in the first place.
The White House announced a new proposal to change from family-based migration to merit-based. Would you support that move?
I do support that move. I proposed similar legislation about 2 years ago called the RAISE Act. Much of the White House proposal is built upon that.
How does that work? Act.
So rather than having a bunch of set-asides and quotas for various nations or kinds of professions, it would go to a very simple points-based system for awarding green cards. Canada, Australia, New Zealand have similar systems on which I modeled my legislation. So you would get more points for being younger, for having English-speaking ability, for having an advanced degree, especially in a film like science or technology, for having a job that already pays you more than what you the median wage in a local area where you're going to be living. I'll obviously want to review the final legislation before I make a decision on it, but that's the direction we need to move with our immigration system, is to get the kind of high-skilled workers we need, you know, engineers, doctors, architects, while protecting blue-collar workers and the wage growth we finally started to see in the last couple of years for them.
And where do you see a path forward for the millions who are living in America who are undocumented?
Part of the problem with immigration legislation over the last 10 years is it's tried to boil the ocean, to do every single thing at once. I think the president recognized that. That's what I recognized a couple of years ago. So trying to find areas where the parties have agreed in the past, like the need to move to high-skilled immigration for our legal immigration system, without getting bogged down in contentious debates about every single issue that touches upon immigration.
Now, you've had a fair bit to say about Iran. In conversation at Council on Foreign Relations in 2017, you had this to say.
While the credible threat of military action may be all that's needed to change the regime's behavior, let there be no doubt about this point. If we are forced to take action, the United States has the ability to totally destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And if they choose to rebuild it, we can destroy it again. Until they get the picture.
Iran has toyed with the idea of enriching uranium recently. Do you think the U.S. needs to take military action?
Well, first, the United States military could totally destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure or its military or anything of our choosing. Our military is the world's mightiest. Iran's is a third-rate military. Second, though, the actions that we have taken in the last 2 weeks in terms of deploying a new aircraft carrier to the region, sending those B-52 bombers, adding Patriot missile defense systems to the region, are not designed to take military action against Iran. They're designed to respond to military action by Iran, or hopefully to deter it from happening in the first place. But there should be no doubt, if Iran were to take provocative action against the United States, our personnel, or our allies in the region, we would respond militarily, and that response would be ferocious.
Let's move on to one other key adversary. In an interview with CBS last week, you talked about the possible trade war with China.
So these tariffs are going to end up hurting both Chinese and some Americans, I'll grant you that. I think they'll ultimately hurt the Chinese more than they will Americans, in part because Chinese companies and their government have been cheating the United States for so long. There will be some sacrifice on the part of Americans, I grant you that. But I also would say that sacrifice is pretty minimal compared to the sacrifices that our soldiers make overseas, that our fallen heroes who are laid to rest in Arlington make, that I write about
well,
in Sacred Duty.
You can't compare those two sacrifices.
That's right. And then when, when I'm home in Arkansas, I hear from farmers who are worried about opening up new markets and getting their products to market. But they also understand that China is a serious competitor of the United States and wants to displace us around the world. And they look at the sacrifices that, that soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines make around the world, and they're willing to bear some of those sacrifices in the short term to hopefully in the long term ensure our long-term prosperity and security.
So what are Americans who are impacted by the tariffs supposed to do in the meantime? How are they supposed to adjust?
Well, when I speak to Arkansans, I was speaking to them this weekend when I was at home, they understand that China has been waging a trade war against the United States for the last 30 years. It's simply a matter of the United States joining that trade war over the last 2 years. So what the president is trying to do is get a better deal for all Americans, our farmers, our ranchers, our foresters, our manufacturers, in addition to our consumers who may pay slightly higher prices if this trade war goes on for a long time. That's why he's not using tariffs as a permanent policy, but as a short-term tool to try to get a better deal. But I don't think there's much doubt that China has more at stake here. If all those production facilities in China move to countries that are more friendly towards the United States and allied with the United States, like Vietnam and Taiwan, then we will ultimately begin to see a restoration of our trade relations with East Asia, but China will lose those businesses permanently. That's why China has more at stake. That's one of the reasons why China has more at stake right now. And I think the president is right to continue to try to put pressure on China to change their behavior and give the United States a fair shake.
A quick question from Maureen via email. This is on the immigration issue that we touched on a moment ago. She wants to know, what is your stand on a path to citizenship for those who have served honorably in the U.S. military?
So I think that's one of the small categories where you could find consensus sooner rather than later. You know, when you're talking about 12 million illegal aliens or perhaps more in our country, that's a very controversial position. But when you're talking about those who have raised their hands and kind of came forward and said, yes, I'm here in the country illegally, many of them were brought illegally as young children, but I'm willing to serve the United States, wear our country's uniform. That's not numbers in the hundreds or the thousands. And I think most Americans would agree that if they're willing to make that kind of sacrifice to serve our nation for years in our country, that we should take account for that fact and help get them to be regularized. And ultimately, like anyone else who has regular status in this country on a visa or a green card, have a chance to become an American citizen.
Now, I promise we'd switch gears to Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. That's the name of your new book. Now, your line of work is extremely political. You're a Republican senator with the president's ear, yet this book isn't political at all. Why did you make that choice?
So the Sacred Duty tells the story of the old guard of Arlington. Arlington is a very special place for our nation. When I talk to Arkansans who visit me here in Washington, I ask them what the highlight of their trip is, and they almost always say Arlington National Cemetery. And you can see it on the faces of those people who are watching the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, who catch a glimpse of a military honor funeral in the cemetery, especially those family members who have had a loved one laid to rest by the old guard. How we honor our troops and how we especially honor those who have given their all in combat and are burying them in Arlington National Cemetery, I think says a lot about our nation. It also talks about the ties that bind us as a nation. You know, in his first inaugural, Lincoln talked about the mystic cords of memory that spread across the land, tying us together. Those mystic cords of memory stretch from patriot graves and battlefields, as Lincoln said in that speech. And there's no place that has more patriot graves in Arlington, no place that combines the spirit of America by showing the love that we have for our fallen heroes in Arlington.
You joined the military after finishing law school. Can you tell us about that choice?
Yeah, I had to redeem myself after finishing law school by joining the Army. So I was actually in my final year of law school, and the 9/11 attacks happened. And from that point forward, I really wanted to serve. I finished school and worked for a couple years to pay off my loans, but the desire to serve had never changed. So I signed up, and a recruiter, to his credit, didn't try to force me to go in the JAG Corps, signed me up for the infantry, and I got a chance to do what I signed up to do, which is become an infantry officer, go to Ranger School, Airborne School, lead a platoon of the 101st Airborne Iraq in 2006, and then that's where I got the notice from the Army that I'd be going to Arlington National Cemetery to serve with the old guard, as I write in Sacred Duty.
Diane from Facebook, she writes, how are you helping living vets? Some remain homeless and with no access to health care. The VA was gifted the largest budget ever for fiscal year 2020. What are you personally doing to help vets in distress today?
We're working to try to make sure the VA is serving all veterans where they are and how they want to be served. So, for instance, we've not only increased the budget of the VA over the last few years, but we've also given veterans more choices. You know, if you live in Arkansas, for instance, next to Little Rock or Fayetteville, where we have two pretty good large VA hospitals, you can go there. If you live at a far remove, maybe in a small town, we're given more flexibility to see local physicians and go to local clinics and so forth. Then there's the whole host of veterans benefits that are in addition to health care. So things like the 9/11 GI Bill or the VA Home Loan Program, making sure that the VA is processing those in a quick fashion. We do that as a matter of policy in Washington, but we also help veterans all across Arkansas. You know, it's a rare occasion for me to be back in the state when I don't have a veteran say that we've had a challenge with the bureaucracy. We help them cut through that bureaucracy and try to get to an answer as quickly as possible. Because I truly do believe, just like I write in Sacred Duty, what we do for our fallen heroes, we must also do for the veterans who have borne our battle, sometimes are struggling to get the benefits they earned from our federal government.
Speaking of Sacred Duty, how did this book happen? What was the research and the writing process like?
Well, a lot of nights and weekends around my day job. So I spent a lot of time back at Arlington National Cemetery and back at Fort Myer, the adjacent military base that is the home of the Old Guard. I shadowed them on missions to the White House, to the National Archives. I observed funerals in the cemetery. I spent a lot of late nights at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is obviously manned 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Sacred Duty tells the story of the Old Guard of Arlington, which in many ways is the story of our history as a nation, because the Old Guard is 3 years older than our Constitution. I do share some of my own personal experiences, like what it's like to stand at Dover Air Force Base and carry the flag-draped remains of my fallen comrades off an aircraft from Iraq or Afghanistan. But this book is the story of the Old Guard, because I think their story really does tell a lot about our story as a nation and what we hold most dear.
We've gotten a lot of questions about Ed Gallagher and other servicemen convicted or accused of war crimes. What's your take?
I'd have to review the individual circumstances of those cases. Soldiers do engage in misconduct. When they do, they ought to be held accountable. In my units, we had soldiers engage in low-level misconduct for which they received low-level punishments. But I can't speak in an informed fashion without reviewing the particular details of each case. In general, I trust our military chain of command to instill good order and discipline. I also, of course, would want to look very carefully and give the benefit of the doubt to soldiers who face very tough situations. So I can't speak as a general matter, but those are kind of the general principles I would apply with more information about particular cases.
Now, how much of what you learned is unwritten? You talk about the bottle cap trick very early on in the book. You know, anything else?
So the bottle cap trick goes to Flags Inn, which will be the Thursday before Memorial Day every year. The Old Guard takes off its ceremonial uniforms and puts on their combat fatigues and marches into the Army in a very military-like operations with detailed schedules and phase lines to put a small American flag in front of every gravesite, now approaching almost 250,000 in Arlington. After about two rows of headstones of my own in 2007, my hand was pretty ate up. So I asked my young soldiers how they were moving so fast, and they all had bottle caps, like, say, a Snapple bottle cap in their hand, and I didn't have one. They looked at me with astonishment. That was a mistake on par with forgetting one's rifle or night vision goggles on a patrol in Iraq. Fortunately, one soldier had a few, and he squared me away, and we went on. But that's a good example of how much of what you learn in the Army is unwritten. It's not in a field manual. You don't learn it in the schoolhouse. It's not even in the written operation order. But you depend on each other. You depend on more seasoned soldiers to learn little tricks or techniques that sometimes can make the difference between mission failure and mission success. That's true in Arlington, just like it's true in combat.
And you talk about the Old Guard handling 20 to 30 or so funerals per day. That sounds like it's got to be tough. What happens when the funeral is angry and sad?
So the Old Guard can do up to 20 or 30 funerals a day, especially during the summer months, which is considered the busy season at Arlington. That means soldiers can perform 6 to 7 funerals a day. And you're right, just like at any other family funeral, you can have family divisions or very deep pain and anguish, especially for those active duty funerals. But the Old Guard's role there is not to grieve, it's not to counsel. The Old Guard's role is to honor, to give those family members the space they need to work through their particular grief. It can be difficult to maintain one's composure, especially when you're standing at the head of a casket or on that casket team, next just a few steps away from a young widow and parents who are grieving the loss of a young American soldier. But again, we train extensively to maintain that kind of composure, and it's drilled into us from the very beginning. And as I write in Sacred Duty, the drilling stops because pretty quickly you internalize that message and what the nation expects from you as an Old Guard soldier to pay tribute to our fallen heroes and to honor their families.
The White House is currently controlled by Republicans. If President Trump loses in 2020 or finishes another term after 2024, will you run for office in the next election?
Well, I am running for office in the next election, re-election to the United States Senate in 2020. But beyond that, I wouldn't want to speculate. You know, as I write in Sacred Duty, I joined the Army in coming out of my last year of law school when the 9/11 attacks happened. That's not certainly what I would have expected when I started law school by any means. I had a very circuitous route into politics. So one thing I learned on that day, I think so many of our fellow citizens learned who had their lives upended, is that while it's good to have a life plan, it's better to write your plan in pencil because you never quite know what's going to be put in front of your path.
Next up, more with Senator Tom Cotton and more of your questions, too. Stay with us.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
1965. A darkened street corner in Selma, Alabama, and a murder. A new podcast exposes the lies that kept this murder from being solved.
And explores memory, myth, and accountability for a crime at the heart of the civil rights movement. From NPR, White Lies. Listen and subscribe now.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're talking with Senator Tom Cotton about his new book, Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. But let's jump back into the news for just a moment. Do you feel the Alabama law goes too far? And that's in relation to abortion, what we discussed earlier.
Sasha, I'm pro-life, like a lot of Arkansans are. We have one of the most pro-life states in the union. So I won't get into the details of every single state's law. I know many people object to the Alabama law, just like many people object to the New York law, which allows abortion almost up to the point of birth. I will say that I think that we should do everything we can to try to find consensus on this issue. One of the reasons why I think it's been unproductive for unelected judges in Washington to make these decisions for Americans and take it out of the process of democratic debate is it undercuts the ability for Americans through their elected representatives to make those decisions for themselves. But I think we should all be able to agree, for instance, that a civilized society should not permit things like sex selection abortion. You know, if parents want to choose the sex of their child, often choosing to have a male child as opposed to a female child. I think if a child can survive outside the mother's womb in a NICU, the way so many of our amazing NICU doctors can help a child at 22 or even 20, maybe even 18 weeks survive, that we ought to protect that innocent life. So as long as we're governed by the Supreme Court on this question, on our right and left limits, we should try to find inside those limits ways that we can find common ground and protect the most innocent among us.
So you don't think it's so much of a woman's choice of what happens with her body?
I think that it's ultimately a choice that we have to make when we're passing our laws. One reason why I think the Supreme Court shouldn't have taken this out of the hands of the American people is because ultimately it's a moral question about what we will permit in our society to happen. Women have as much say in that as men do because they vote just like men do for their own elected representatives. But ultimately it's a moral question about what a civilized society should and should not permit. For instance, earlier this year we tried to pass a bill in the Senate that would require doctors and hospitals to care for a newborn child if it survived an attempted abortion, just like they would care for any other child or any other person. It's pretty astonishing that most Democrats voted against that. I think most Americans say that we should protect the new child in those cases.
Now, Kate, via Twitter, she writes to us, why did you vote against the Violence Against Women Act?
I think Kate's referring to the 2013 bill. The 2013 bill had some provisions in it that were troubling to me about the rights of the accused on Indian reservations. If you're an American citizen that goes on an Indian reservation and you're accused of violence rather than being prosecuted by a U.S. attorney or by a local prosecuting attorney, that law would have allowed Indian tribes, sometimes very small Indian tribes in which everyone is almost by definition related, to be able to adjudicate those claims. I think that could set a dangerous precedent for the rights of accused American citizens. Of course, we all want to stop violence against women. I support law enforcement strongly. But I also take very seriously the rights of the accused in our society to have a fair and impartial jury and judge whenever they are accused of a crime.
Danny via Facebook, and these are coming rapid fire here. I want to just get all these comments in. As one of his constituents, I want him to explain why he's telling American farmers to roll over in foreclosure. It's not as if they're dying like soldiers. Is he trying to finish what Reagan started? It sounds as if he'd rather big corporations take over the American farmer. He's too much of a coward to have a town hall that isn't stacked with his base.
Sounds like we may have some disagreements there. But what I want to have happen for Arkansas farmers is to get a fair shake. For decades, they have not gotten a fair shake from China. So, for instance, Sasha, rice is our largest commodity in Arkansas. Rice is terribly discriminated against to the point of almost not being sold at all in many countries all around the world. China, though, is one of the most notorious countries when it comes to cheating our farmers. So, yes, I'd like to see those markets open. But for 30 years, what we've been trying, which is essentially letting China have one-sided trade deals and distill our intellectual property to include some of our rice genomes from rice producers in Arkansas, hasn't worked. So what we're trying to do is help farmers and ranchers and foresters, in addition to manufacturers, get a fair trade deal that ultimately will help them, that will help family farmers be able to maintain their family farms by opening up new markets for them.
What, just jumping back to Iran, what would Iran have to do for U.S. military action to be taken?
So, for instance, in the 1980s, Iran was attacking U.S.-flagged oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. If Iran were to attack a U.S.-flagged vessel, or in Iraq, one of its proxies were to launch an attack against a U.S. military installation or U.S. military troops, I would expect to have a very stern response against Iran.
And we have another email here. This one comes from, let's see here, this one comes Actually, we have no name here. It just says, sorry, Senator Cotton, but coming from a family of Marines, I'll tell you that Trump set up this coming war with Iran by pulling out of the nuclear deal. Make no mistake that Bolton is leading us to a war that will only spill blood of more Americans.
So first, advisors advise and presidents decide. So the president has many advisors, but ultimately he's the one to decide. That's true of this president as it was true of the 44 that preceded him. Second, pulling out of the nuclear deal did not precipitate this crisis. What's precipitated this crisis in the Middle East over the last 2 weeks is Iran lashing out because of the pressure that our nation is now putting on Iran. The nuclear deal was flawed in a couple of ways. One, it didn't really stop Iran from ultimately getting a nuclear weapon. But two, it was only a nuclear deal. It didn't touch on Iran's support for terrorist groups like Hamas, which have been firing missiles into Israel. It didn't touch on their support for rebel groups that are trying to overthrow the governments of their neighbors. And in fact, it empowered those actions by Iran by giving them billions and billions of dollars to fund groups like Hezbollah and Hamas or the Houthi rebels in Yemen. The actions we've taken over the last year since we've withdrawn from the nuclear deal has helped put pressure on the Iranian regime to stop its malign activities throughout the region. And as I said earlier, we're not deploying an aircraft carrier and B-52 bombers and Patriot missile systems to the Middle East to take military action against Iran. We're deploying those to respond to military action that Iran might take, or we hope, deter it altogether.
Jessica from Twitter, she wants to know, why did you send the letter that you did to Iran several years ago, and what did you hope to accomplish by doing so?
So 46 senators and I in 2015 released a public letter to the Ayatollahs because it was very clear that either Secretary Kerry wasn't explaining to them the nature of a treaty in our system of government, or his counterpart Javad Zarif was not taking that back to Tehran. But we simply made two points that are beyond dispute. One, if you want a lasting and binding agreement with the United States, it needs to be a treaty. That's what Vladimir Putin sought in 2010 with the New START nuclear arms control treaty. And two, that future presidents or future Congresses, if it wasn't a treaty, would be able to stop that agreement with stroke of a pen. I would say I was proven right in 2018 when President Trump did exactly that.
Is America putting enough pressure on Iran?
I think everything we've done over the last year, especially over the last 2 months, has been moving in the right direction. So, for instance, just in the last couple months, we have designated the shock troops of the Iranian Revolution, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, as a foreign terrorist organization, exactly what they are. We've also eliminated all the exceptions to the oil export ban, which will have a potentially catastrophic effect on the Iranian economy, taking from where it is now, a recession, into what may be a depression, but also depriving the Revolutionary Guard Corps of hundreds of millions of dollars that they use to support terrorist groups like Hamas and Hezbollah.
And with the thinking of the European Union, they aren't taking the same measures. So is America applying pressure by itself enough?
First, the American economy is by far the largest in the world. Iran's economy, by contrast, is about the size of Maryland's. Not many companies or countries would decide to do business with an economy the size of Maryland's at risk of doing business with the United States. I wish the European Union, especially Germany and France, would do more to put pressure on Iran. I think they ultimately will. It's just, as it often is with those partners, sometimes a long and winding road to get them into the same policy that the United States has.
Senator Tom Cotton is a Republican representing Arkansas. He also served as an infantryman in the U.S. Army. His new book is Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. More with Senator Cotton in a moment. Stay close.
Support also comes from Google. Veteran Mitch Hoyt founded Skinny Sticks Maple Syrup, and he's showing that small businesses can do big things. Mitch started making syrup from a few trees in his Wisconsin backyard and now is connecting with customers worldwide with help from Google Tools. Skinny Sticks is one of millions of small businesses using Google to grow. Learn how Google is helping businesses in your state at google.com/economic impact.
Hey, it's Guy here with a very exciting announcement. This coming October, we're going to be coming back to the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco for our second How I Built This Summit, supported by American Express. Over the course of 2 days, I'll have conversations with some of our most remarkable founders from the show, including David Neeleman of JetBlue, Marcia Kilgore of Bliss, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger of Instagram, Stuart Butterfield of Slack, Jen Rubio of Away, and many, many more. The summit is an incredible opportunity to connect with other entrepreneurs and builders just like you from around the world. Last year's summit sold out early, so to find out how to get tickets, visit summit.npr.org. And I hope to see you in San Francisco.
Back now to our conversation with U.S. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas. He's a veteran of the Old Guard, the Army unit that oversees military burials at Arlington National Cemetery, just outside Washington, D.C. And switching over, Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery, your book. What do you hope readers take away from that?
Every story in Arlington, or every headstone in Arlington, tells a story. You can go there and you can look at those headstones. You can quickly Google the names and learn the circumstances of that soldier's passing. One good way to understand those stories and the sacrifice they've paid to our nation is to understand the young soldiers of the Old Guard who perform those military honor funerals or guard the tomb of the unknown soldier. They are acting on our behalf as a nation, as an expression of respect, reverence, and even love for what that we have for all of the soldiers who had laid down their life in defense of our nation from the Revolutionary War up to today. And for all those who haven't been to Arlington and may not be able to come, or all those who have been and just want to know more about how those soldiers perform, Sacred Duty will give them a chance to look behind the scenes and understand how that ethos of excellence, striving for perfection, spending hours and hours on a perfect uniform or perfecting your craft of, say, folding a flag, really is an expression that our nation has for love, for the its love for our fallen heroes.
And Julie, via email, she has a comment. Looks like she had a recent visit. She says, our eighth graders from Incarnation in Dayton, Ohio, returned from our D.C. trip this past Thursday. Our tour guide did a fabulous job of conveying the sacrifice of our soldiers buried in Arlington and the respect they deserve. We had students who had the privilege of laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns. And Susie, our tour guide, asked our students to walk out of Arlington silently. And they did, she says. Is that sort of the feeling that you're speaking of?
Arlington really is sacred ground. Many people know of its connection to Robert E. Lee's family. He married Mary Custis, who was the heir of Arlington. Mary Custis's father, though, Robert E. Lee's father-in-law, was George Washington's adopted son. And Arlington in its early days was known as Mount Washington. And for most of the 19th century until the Civil War, it was known as Washington's Treasury. So it has a deep connection to the father of our country. It's also a place that was born in the ashes of the Civil War, when Americans raised arms against each other to such an extent that a plantation across the river had to become a graveyard for the Union War dead, and ultimately our national cemetery. That's why the kind of experience that we hear from those eighth grade students you see every single day in Arlington, there's just something about being an American, as I write in Sacred Duty, that when you walk into Arlington, a sense of peace and calm comes over you. I see it on all my trips to Arlington. I see it at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier when you have eighth graders who aren't known for being the most quiet and reverential age stand in amazement watching those young tomb sentinels do the changing of the guard. And I would encourage all of your listeners, if they're in the Capital Region or if they can take one field trip, to try to take a field trip to Arlington National Cemetery. You can go on Arlington's website, make a request to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. You can take them on a walk among the headstones to point out some of the more famous headstones so they can learn about the sacrifices our nation or our fallen heroes have made for our nation.
Now, Tom, Jennifer, via Facebook, she writes, "Why were you compelled to compare our farmers to our military service members? I found it absurd and manipulative."
It was in the course of an interview about sacred duty and about the sacrifices that our soldiers make. So the interviewers wanted to ask about trade as well. And that's how the comparison came up.
Now, how long did it take? We talked before about some of the writing process. How long altogether did it take to do your research and all for the book?
About 10 months from the time I first returned to Arlington and Fort Myer and started interviewing soldiers to the time I turned in the manuscript. It'll be about 15 months all told from that date to last week when the book was published. That's kind of fast for a book. Most books take 18 to 24 months. But we knew we wanted Sacred Duty to be published going into Memorial Day, the most important day of the year at Arlington National Cemetery. And for the Old Guard, as I write in Sacred Duty, about 500 soldiers work on Memorial Day to perform the National Memorial Day observance, just like they go in the Thursday before Memorial Day for Flags In. That's a very important time for our nation, and I wanted Sacred Duty, the story of those young soldiers in the Old Guard and Arlington National Cemetery, to be out and available for our fellow citizens.
And I was actually just going to touch on that. For those who don't know, what is describe Flags In? It's coming up later this week.
So on Thursday afternoon, as the final funerals end, every soldier in the Old Guard, not just the infantrymen, but the cooks and the clerks and the mechanics, put on their combat fatigues. The only time of the year they wear combat fatigues in Arlington. They march in a very precise, detailed army operation, complete with phase lines and overhead graphics, and they put a small flag at every gravesite in Arlington, now numbering almost a quarter of a million. And that is a way to say to all of those fallen heroes across the ages, as well as to their families and all the visitors to Arlington, that there was a soldier at this grave, and he had a brief moment with his forerunner to honor his service and thank him for his sacrifice. And they'll be conducting patrols all weekend long to replace flags that have been taken or flags that have been damaged or knocked over. So everyone, every day they go into Arlington over the four-day weekend, will see all those flags lined up in a perfect symmetrical fashion as a symbol of our love and reverence for our nation's fallen heroes.
And I just want to jump back briefly in the time that we have. Lots of comments coming in and questions. Gretchen on Facebook, she says, "Do you believe that the huge, ever-increasing amount of money needed to run a viable campaign for Congress or Senate has had a corrupting impact on government? If yes, what would you propose to address this problem?" And let's keep that brief.
No, I don't. We spend much less on politics in this country than we spend on potato chips or toothpaste. And oftentimes, as you see in the Democratic presidential primary, financial contributions are a way for people to support a candidate of their choice when they have too busy a life, when they're too busy at work or have kids, to be able to knock on doors or stuff envelopes or volunteer in another way.
And so in this book, you are hoping next to do what with it?
Well, I hope that everyone enjoys the story in Sacred Duty about the young soldiers who all honor our nation's fallen heroes. And I've enjoyed talking about it. I thank you for having me on today, and I look forward to talking about it with many other Americans.
Lots of interesting detail I found as well when I read it. So thank you so much for sharing that. Senator Tom Cotton's new book is called Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Remember, you can connect with us about upcoming episodes and debates online at the1a.org. Click on Ask 1A. That's the word the, the number one, the letter A, dot org. And click Ask 1A. Today's show was produced by Jonquilin Hill and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about JQ, Miranda, and the rest of the team, go to the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.